Thank you for listening to EU Radio for this interview recorded here at the European Parliament in Strasbourg during this plenary session of the European deputies, the last of this mandature. Our topic for this interview is the development of a right to repair in Europe. To explore this topic, I'm pleased to receive René Repazzi. Hello.
Hello.
René Repazzi, you're a European deputy from Germany, member of the group of the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats here in the European Parliament. You're especially part of the Committee on the Internal Market and dedicated to the consumer protection. And in this frame, you are the rapporteur on a legislative directive that deals with the reinforcement in Europe of a right to repair. On this Tuesday, the 23rd of April, this directive was adopted. Can you remind us what changes this directive will bring into force in Europe?
Sure, these are quite meaningful changes. Because the whole point of this directive was to promote, indeed, repair. And we have basically three situations in which we have to make repair more attractive. The first one is after you have purchased the goods, so within the minimum guarantee period. If there is something going wrong, then you can go to your seller and may choose between repair or new product. Now, consumers tend to go for a new product, so we made repair more attractive by introducing an additional, top-up of 12 months, of at least 12 months, for the minimum guarantee period. If you have your good repaired within the first 24 months, and then you have basically a longer guarantee period than if you just ask for a new good. Second, and that is the most important one, after the expiry of the minimum guarantee period, consumers will now have a legal claim to repair against the producers. Moreover, we make repair more attractive if you basically, as a consumer, do what you normally do. You just go around the corner, find a repair shop and say, please repair it. Nowadays, repairers have then to show an estimation of costs, which is extremely high due to extraordinary spare part prices. And we said, okay, we have to bring those prices down. And we do so by requiring that spare parts must now have a reasonable price. And there are some spare parts where nobody can explain that it's reasonable. And second, that we remove repair barriers due to software, hardware, or contractual techniques. Think of the loss of the commercial guarantee because you let it repair by used spare parts. Or think of 3D printed spare parts, and afterwards part of the software is not using anymore, cannot be used anymore. So these kind of barriers, they are now prohibited. And that is going to make repair less costly and therefore a choice for consumers. And lastly, we require from member states that they adopt supporting measures for repairs, such as repair vouchers, establishing repair cafes or repair fund in order to make repair affordable.
So who is the main target here? Consumers, producers, member states?
Depends on who is the target. It's, of course, consumers, because they buy the product and they are supposed then to let it repair instead of buying a new product and then throwing away the old one. But also SMEs in particular in the repair services sector, so that we are getting more repair service providers that can compete with each other and whose market is growing.
All categories of products are in the frame of this new rules?
Unfortunately not. If you're looking at the minimum guarantee period, that obviously applies to all product. It doesn't change. So the extension of the by the 12 months minimum guarantee period is applicable to all products. When we look, however, at the right to repair after the expiry of the minimum guarantee period and all these benefits to make spare parts more affordable, they are limited to certain product categories. But this is quite still already an extensive list of product categories. The most important household products are in there, such as white goods, so refrigerators and dishwashers, but also vacuum cleaners, cell phones, laptops, tablets, batteries. That list can, however, be still expanded by the European Commission. The idea behind this is that one must request from producers repairability requirements under EU law, so that they actually know what spare parts have to be held at stock for a certain period of time. And that only if we have provided for that, then we can extend the scope of the right to repair to it. Honestly, I can understand why this is this. Convincing, I don't find it. I personally think our individual right to repair should also be applicable to all sort of categories after the expiry of the minimum guarantee period. But there was no majority in plenary for this, and there was no support by the council on that. But it is still my objective because the fight continues.
Speaking about majorities, this directive on the right to repair was adopted this Tuesday with almost 600 votes in favor, only 3 against. Was it a surprise? You were talking about this agreement. Does it mean all political groups in the European Parliament are agreeing with the right to repair?
Yeah, funny enough, they did. So because indeed this was such a broad majority, I think the broadest that we had this week on any of the plenary votes. And we also saw it in the debate that we had on Monday, that everybody was praising it, from the hardcore left to the ID group and the commission and the council. So everybody was praising it, which basically can give you the impression, okay, either we did something wrong because something more could have been achieved with some more resistance, or we did everything right, so we got people convinced. Honestly, obviously, I'm convinced of the latter, since if you compare what we now as a final result have to the original proposal and to the council's negotiation position, we are way more ambitious than that. Huh? We made the commission proposal more ambitious, and the council went the extra way in order to accept many improvements that the parliament has introduced. That is something that rarely happened in the last half year. It was either the opposite, that we always had to rubber stamp what the council wanted. And that makes it that these were very special circumstances due to the very fact that this is obviously a gain for consumers, it is obviously a gain for medium-sized enterprises, and that brought political forces together. But also because in the negotiations, the biggest stumbling blocks were indeed set aside, such as the issue of the scope.
So in the end, it's a victory for you. You're satisfied.
I am. And because we, in the very beginning, I thought that this proposal did not aim what is in reality the problem, namely repair barriers in terms of spare part prices and in terms of limiting possibilities to repair products by software means, by hardware means, by contractual means, etc. That was put in there. It was in my very first draft report. It was not tabled by anyone except for us and the Greens. It survived the plenary. It survived the trilogue negotiations, although the council has not touched the matter. But we got it through the final trilogue and now in the final results, and that makes it that I'm very happy about it. It was a major step, but I'm also aware that this is not the end of the story.
Can you explain our listeners in which way this text, this directive, will help the environmental transition?
Mm-hmm. If we look at one of the major issues that is currently problematic for our environment is the growing rubbish mountains, so to say, of electronic devices, because we throw them away after 1 or 2 years, either small devices like smartphones, but also larger things such as refrigerators, dishwashers, etc. And it's growing and it's growing and it's growing, and you have to do something with it. And it is not really properly recycled. It is just a burden on the environment. And by having products living longer, by having products being used longer, we reduce the rubbish mountain and by that help the environment.
Is there in the frame of this directive kind of a preference for choosing to repair inside the EU or not? Because if it's still cheaper and easier to send your damaged product abroad, outside of the EU, the environmental benefit will still not be that high.
Yes, this is indeed right. And that is why I was so insisting on making the situation of independent repairers more attractive. Because from a consumer's perspective, if you have to go to the hassle to put your product into a parcel, send it off to China, have to wait 3 months and then it is sent back, you don't want to go there. You just say, okay, whatever, I throw it away. On the top of the environmental arguments, consumers will then simply not choose for repair. But what they want, they want to have a quick fix, and the quick fix is around the corner, so that that they can go there and get a competitive price that is at least as competitive as the producer one, maybe a bit more expensive, because I believe not having this hassle, consumers consumers are willing to pay a price, but not extensively more expensive. And that makes it why it is so core to strengthen the position of independent repairers if we want to promote the right to repair.
You were saying this is not the end of the story. What will be the next step regarding this text and this right to repair in Europe?
So the first thing is, and we have to hold the European Commission here very much to account, is that they expand the list of product categories to which the right to repair is applicable. They promise so because they are negotiating under a different legislation, the eco-design regulation, more and more repairability requirements for other product categories. And once they have done so, they must include those product categories into the annex of the directive, which expands the scope. But this requires that we look at it, that we watch it, and that whenever the future commissioner is talking about the matter, we have to raise the subject. So that's the first thing. The second thing that is still unsolved is the issue of intellectual property. Because if you look at the barriers that I was just mentioning, in particular of software nature, now there are famous smartphone producers who then say that they have to shut off certain parts of their operating system due to safety reasons or due to intellectual property reasons because non-original parts would endanger the security of the safety of the device or the way of how that particular design is made. Or think of 3D printing, that they say, well, we have a copyright on this, so you're not allowed to use 3D printed parts, etc. So the intellectual property element can still serve as a basis for justification of barriers. And it is very extensively served. Now, this right to repair didn't have the proper legal basis to deal with issues of intellectual property. And this is the main thing we still have to address. So we need to have a debate in the next mandate on how we have to change or adopt and adjust our intellectual property law in order to properly promote repair and not to be a barrier to repair.
To do another comparison, these rules about intellectual property will still need to be modernized or modified also because of the massive arrival of artificial intelligence.
Indeed. So there are many challenges to intellectual property anyway. Our intellectual property is not yet updated to the new objectives of EU policies, in particular those of the Green Deal, but also of the digitalization. You're totally right. It is always a very problematic matter because there are enormous industrial commercial interests behind it. So lobbying is going to be extremely tough when it comes. And this in the European Parliament, the perspective of which is to have a rather right-leaning majority. So it's going to be certainly a tough one, but it doesn't take away that it has to be addressed.
Maybe one last aspect. You mentioned another text, another legislation voted here at the European Parliament regarding the eco-design and how to improve the creation of sustainable goods in Europe. In the frame of it, for example, the banning of the destruction of unsold products, especially for textile and clothes inside the EU. I could have also quoted the less recent, but still the ongoing adoption of another text, the ban of programmed or early obsolescence of products. All these texts, all these European legislations, does it mean that the EU is now entering or starting a transition toward a more circular economy?
Most definitely. This is precisely what is behind this project. If you have the eco-design regulation, the empowering consumers one, which gives consumers additional rights to enforce all those rights linked to the transformation, the right to repair. It is precisely the idea that we need to really have a proper circular economy within our internal market for the reasons of protecting the climate and the environment, but also when we look at critical raw materials, we have many critical raw materials that we have to import from dubious third countries, laying in the drawers of our desks with tens of generations of cell phones that are laying there around. So a circular economy will lead to more sustainable products that live longer, which is therefore over time also cheaper for consumers. And it makes it if products are brought back in to the system so that we are getting a recycling, so proper circular economy, that it will be given back to the production process. So indeed, all those elements that we did in the last 5 years, they were to boost the circular economy.
And will this boost towards circular economy be your main fight during the next mandate? Because I remind our listeners, you are running yourself for the European elections.
It will certainly be on the top of my agenda.
Thank you very much, René Repazzi, for your participation to this interview on EU Radio. And thank you all for your attention.